This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Show of its kind in Oregon or Southwest Washington. Stay tuned for Prison Pipeline.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up. It's Labor Radio.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from these three local labor unions. SEIU, Local 503, whose members seek a just and vibrant society where everyone is treated with dignity and respect and where all workers have jobs that provide for themselves and their families. Information at SEIU503.org. And from American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Oregon Council 75, representing over 25,000 Oregon public and private sector employees, families, and communities, protecting worker rights and fighting to improve the wages and working conditions of members since 1942. More information at www.OregonAFSCME.com, and also from Oregon Southwest Washington Carpenters Local 156, whose goal is to organize workers, provide a safe work environment, ensure livable wages, and elevate the moral and social condition of its members. Information at ubc156.org. Please stay tuned for Prison Pipeline coming up next.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Good evening and welcome to Prison Pipeline here on KBOO FM 90.7 here in the Portland, Oregon area. I'm here tonight with Vicky Ballou, a local attorney who is working with the CLIF Project, which stands for Changing Lives Forever. It is a project of pro bono law services for children who have been involved in the justice system. I'll cut it off there and I'll let her introduce it a little bit more fully. Vicky, why don't you take a second to introduce yourself and then tell us a little bit about what the CLIF Project is.
Thanks, Peter. My name is Vicky Ballou. I'm a partner at Tonkin Torp. We're a business law firm, and I, in my normal life, am an intellectual property lawyer. But with one of my partners, Gwen Griffith, we started a project at Tonkin called the CLIF Project, which, as you noted, stands for Changing Lives Forever. And it's affiliated with the Youth Rights and Justice pro bono project. And we focus on helping adults who were adjudicated as sex offenders when they were children.
So just quickly for the audience, could you explain what a pro bono project means exactly?
Yes, pro bono is Latin for free, no charge.
So free law services.
Free law services for kids who need it.
Great. And so what do you mean by kids who need it? What are they, bank robbers, or what are we talking here?
We're talking about kids, adults now, who when they were kids were involved in some aspect of some sex offense, and it there's a variety of things that qualify as sex offenses, but these are people who were adjudicated, I think is the right word, when they were kids for some kind of sexual contact with another child.
So you say sexual contact with it. Could you give us examples of what that means?
Sure. We actually see three different kinds of cases. One is what I call the Romeo and Juliet case, and that's where you have usually teenagers, boy and girl, who have sex or some kind of sexual contact. But one of them is older than the other, and as long as one of them is over 12 years old, they have the potential, if they're caught and turned over to the criminal justice system, they can be adjudicated as a juvenile sex offender and placed on the sex offender registry for the rest of their lives.
So is there a necessary difference in age level? Like if the girl is 12 and the guy is 11, does that mean that she's going to get a sex charge? Or how does that look?
I know that there is a 3-year age difference. And if there is a 3-year age difference between the two participating parties, the penalties are less severe.
You mean it's less than a 3-year age difference?
I don't know a lot more than that, because most of the cases that we get have more than a 3-year difference. But you think a 13-year-old and a 17-year-old, that's 4 years. Yet that's not that uncommon to see precocious 13-year-olds and immature 17-year-olds together.
Okay, and so how about the other two types that you mentioned?
The other type, I call it playing doctor, because it's usually quite a bit younger kids, but it's kids who are exploring each other's bodies sexually. In those situations, again, if one of them is older, over 12, and the other one is under 12, then I think the 3-year age difference does not matter. If the victim is under 12, it almost doesn't. It doesn't matter what the difference in age is. And then the third one are really the saddest cases, and that's where the victim is very young. Sometimes the offender is very young as well.
So what happens in a situation like that?
Once it comes to light, we have mandatory reporting, and sometimes it will come to light right away. A teacher, a parent, sometimes it will actually not come to light until quite a bit later. As long as they're adjudicated as a juvenile, they fall within the CLIF project. They have the potential of being helped with the CLIF project. And if they're turned over to the juvenile justice system, they go to court. Depending on the situation, they may go to some detention center. Sometimes they are placed in foster, you know, a different foster home.
Like McLaren here in Oregon.
Or Donald E. Long, or their halfway houses that some of our clients have lived in for a while.
So the mission of CLIF is to get youth who have been adjudicated as sex offenders and required to register as sex offenders off of that sex offender registry.
That's right.
What do you want us to know about that?
Well, I guess one thing I'd like for you to know, one of the points I'd like to make is, you know, people think they lump sex offenders into one giant group. And the conventional wisdom, even though it's not true, is that once a sex offender, always a sex offender. But that is especially not true with kids. So the three points I would like to make are, kids are different. That's number one. Number two, kids are different. And number three, guess what? Kids are different.
Okay, so you mentioned that sometimes the cases don't come to light immediately. Say the case didn't come to light for 10 years, and now both parties are adults. So what does that look like?
I can tell you we have one case that's an outlier, because this was, in fact, someone who was adjudicated as an adult, but for a crime that happened when he was 14. And it was a situation with a family member. I believe it was either a half-sister or a stepsister. There was sexual contact. When she was quite a bit older, and he had by that time left the house and had joined the military and was doing very well, she happened to mention to some to a church counselor that she and her brother had had sexual contact, and the church counselor reported that, and so he was adjudicated as an adult. Unfortunately, he's in a really difficult situation because the laws are not as available to help him get off the sex offender registry, even though if it had been caught earlier, he would have been better off, because the law does provide for a way for juvenile sex offenders. It's difficult, but there is a way for them to get off the registry.
Tell us a little bit more about what the consequences of a child being on the sex offender registry look like here in Oregon.
First of all, you have to realize it's not just the child that's on the sex offender registry. It impacts the entire family, because the stigma. Now, Oregon is lucky in one sense, at least right now. Juvenile sex offenders are on the registry, but their names are not available to the public. So it is possible, if you want to call in and ask, you can, but it's not as freely available as an adult sex offender's name would be. That, you know, that's one consequence, is just the stigma. Once the offender grows up, well, even before the offender grows up, there are other consequences. We have clients who have been asked to leave their community college and college classroom courses because there is someone under 18 who is in a class, and so it affects their education. It affects their ability to get jobs. Even Goodwill will not hire someone who is on the sex offender registry. It affects their ability to get housing, especially subsidized housing, but even private housing, because landlords sometimes will check on, do background checks and find out that as a child, someone was on the sex offender registry. One thing people don't realize is that it's actually almost like you're a prisoner in the state of Oregon, because if you are in the state of Oregon, you cannot travel outside the state of Oregon if you are on the sex offender registry without getting permission.
And who would give permission in this case? Parole and probation, or the police department, or...
I believe it's the parole officer, although I don't get involved at that level, so I believe it's the probation officer.
And so why is the CLIF Project important now?
Well, I think the CLIF Project is important whether you think the sex registry is a good idea or not. If you think the sex registry is a good idea, then you want it because it's going to help protect society from sexual predators.
And in what way?
Well, if there is someone who is a sexual predator, having that person's name available to the public might help. And I'm not saying I agree with that, but I think there are arguments to be made that there could be some protective benefit by having a valid sex offender registry. The problem is that in Oregon and nationally, you have so many people on the sex offender registry that it really becomes meaningless. And so you're actually better off, even if you believe in having a sex offender registry, you're much better off to have fewer people, the people who really are a threat to society, and not people who offended as a juvenile and hasn't reoffended since. I don't know if I mentioned this or not, Peter, but the Oregon Youth Authority, which is a state agency that oversees youth in the criminal justice system, they have said that the recidivism rate for juvenile sex offenders is only 4%. So there's only a 4% chance that a kid who has completed treatment through the OYA is going to ever reoffend again.
So that's almost 1 in 20. Wouldn't we want a list of those individuals to make sure that we know who it's going to be?
Well, if you could figure out which one of those four out of the 100 were, it makes perfect sense to do it. But I don't think anybody has figured out the litmus test.
So tell us, Vicky Ballou, from the CLIF Project, which stands for...
Changing Lives Forever.
Do you have a story you'd like to tell us?
I have a story I'd love to tell you. It was actually the very first case. Gwen and I did it together. And you have to understand, she's a tax lawyer and I'm an intellectual property lawyer. Neither one of us ever step foot in the courtroom if we can avoid it. But our very first client was a young man who was 12 at the time of the offense. His mother was a drug and alcohol abuser, and the fact that he survived to the age of 12 is somewhat surprising, because from the age of 2 or 3 years old, he was feeding himself, he was taking care of himself, because his mother was in a drug-induced or alcohol-induced coma, and was largely, even though she was physically present in the apartment, she was not there. This young man, and I'm going to call him Jeremy, but that is not his real name, he was angry about this, and he was a terror. He was a terror at school. He was a terror in their apartment complex. And as you can imagine, he wasn't very well liked by the adults in the apartment complex. And he was also unsupervised. As it turns out, he was one of the let's play doctor kinds of cases that I mentioned, where he was 12 and there were two sisters. I believe the ages were 7 and 9. And there was non-forcible touching of hand to genital area. When the parents of the girls found out, they were furious, as, you know, I'm not saying they weren't rightfully furious, but this was a chance to get this kid out of the apartment complex. And so they call the police, and the police saw what the situation was with his mother. They took him out of the home. All the files suggest nobody thought this kid had a sex problem. They all knew he had an anger problem and an impulse control problem. Jeremy resisted treatment. He was uncooperative. He had a parole officer who told him that he was a failure, that he'd never make anything of himself, that he was doomed basically to a life of marginal existence. One day his grandmother and mother, during one of her sober moments, came to see him when he was at one of the juvenile correction facilities, and just said, "Please, Jeremy, just for a week, try cooperating with your parole officer." And by this time, I mean, he was in his late teens. He was resisting. He just was an angry young man, but he decided to try it. Things like actually making eye contact and responding to questions. And he was shocked at the response he got back, because once he started reaching out to them, the people around him, the adults, started warming up to him. And he realized that he could change his life. The other thing that happened was, for some reason, providence or not, his parole officer was transferred out, and he got a new parole officer who met him and said the exact opposite. "Jeremy, if you put your mind to this, you can do anything." And she was so supportive of him that he began to believe in himself, and he completed treatment. When he was 25. I mean, it took him till 25 because it took so long for him to start participating in the treatment. When he was relieved from supervision, he was a hard worker. He put together, he started utilizing the tools that he learned in treatment about anger management and anticipating problems. He was a hard worker. He was working two jobs when we met him, and just trying to find appointment times was difficult because he was working hard. And so we went to, he was not in Multnomah County. He was in a county, the hearing for him was in another county. His parole officer showed up at the hearing, which is not that common, even when they're supportive. One of the things that we told the judge is, because of his anger management problem, we actually believe, both Gwen and I believe, that if he had not gone through the OYA process and the treatment program, that he would be dead today. Gunshot wound, knife fight, who knows, bashed in head. But the program actually, the OYA program turned his life around and gave him the tools he needed that his mom hadn't given him. And the judge at the end of the hearing said to him, "You have demonstrated that you are not a threat to society. I expect great things out of you, and I'm going to sign the order, and you will not have to register as a sex offender anymore." The judge left the chambers, and his grandmother was there with him, and he turned around. She stood up. She was 5'2", and he was 6'6". And he turned around and just wept, gave her a hug. He was draped over. Here's a 6'6" guy draped over this 5'2" grandmother, and they were both just sobbing. And Gwen and I both said that we've never had a legal fee that was better than that one.
So where's Jeremy today? Do you have any idea?
Oh, sure. That's another great thing about this project is that our clients often do stay in touch. He has been promoted. He's found a new job. He now has the potential to really advance in his career. He has a girlfriend. He called and let us know that he has his own apartment for the first time in his life because he'd been pretty much couch surfing because he couldn't get housing. So, yes, we have other clients who've been able to join the military. So it really is the gift that keeps giving back to us because our clients stay in touch.
So how many people has the Cliff Project served at this point?
We've served a little over 20 people at this point. We've gotten our track record is 100% because we take easy cases. We take cases that parole officers are referring to us who they're saying, "I've got this great person, they deserve to be helped." So I don't want to make it sound like we're really good because it's really our clients who are good. But we have we've gotten good results for 6 of our clients, and we have 15 that we're currently working with, so 21 total.
Excellent. How long has this project been going on for? How long has the Cliff Project been going on for?
I believe it's 2 or 3 years now that we've been working on it.
So you mentioned that you get referrals from parole officers. How do you decide on which cases to take?
Well, Gwen, the woman who actually is the co-founder of the project, does an initial intake interview. Well, let me back up. The first screening is the Youth Rights and Justice Project. They will do a screening, and they send us what they call the easy cases. We are getting more and more referrals directly from parole officers and people in the criminal justice system. And Gwen is the gatekeeper. She, if you could see her, she has gray hair. She is just a delightful woman. And so she meets with each client at the beginning, and they have to pass her gut level test because we want to take clients that we think have a reasonably good chance because we have limited resources. We have more people in the pipeline. I think we're awaiting, we have 9 people who we're waiting to assign. So we want to take people that we really think we can help. The second screening then is Gwen will try to find someone in the firm, a lawyer who has finished their last Cliff Project, or someone outside the firm, and see if they would be willing to take another case. And she'll tell them a little bit about the person. They'll decide whether they would like to meet the potential client in person. And then they get to decide whether is this someone that I would like working with. And if both of those situations occur, Gwen says yes, and then the lawyer says yes, then we send out an engagement letter like we would for any other client saying, "Here's what we expect of you, and we're willing to represent you without charging."
So have some people been turned down from this service?
Yes, they have. In some cases, it's because not enough time has elapsed. Sometimes it's because there are other problems that make it unlikely. There are other convictions, maybe not sex offense convictions, but other convictions that are recent that we believe would maybe more time needs to go by before they apply.
What is the biggest obstacle the CLIF project has faced?
When getting the records from the state, because one of the things we do with an intake, we talk to the person, but one of the things we like to do is to find out whether what they're telling us matches what their file says. And so trying to get juvenile record files from the state, rightly so, the state is very protective of juvenile records. Even with a signed consent by the now adult juvenile offender, it is difficult and time-consuming. And the older the case, the more difficult and more time-consuming.
So, Vicki, I think when a lot of our audience, and myself included, when we think about a youth sex offender, we always think generally a boy. But I understand you probably have female clients as well. Do you have a story about one of them?
I do. And let me just give you one statistic to start out with. About 5% of the people who are on the Oregon Sex Offender Registry are women. 95% are men. But yes, we do have women clients as well. One of them was her victim was her younger sister, and there was sexual contact. The home was being investigated for because of parental neglect and abuse. And so through that process, it came out that the older sister had, in fact, had sexual contact with the younger sister. We met this woman when she was in her late 20s or early 30s and had children of her own. And her family was very supportive. Her younger sister was supportive of having her off the sex offender registry. And that is, it's actually not that uncommon that the victim and the victim's family will be supportive. Our client was really anxious to get off the sex offender registry because she had young children of her own. And because she was on the sex offender registry, she could not go to parent-teacher conferences. She could not go to band or choir concerts or sporting events at her children's school. So it really had a huge impact on her. One of my partners, represented her and was able to get her off of the sex offender registry. And again, it changed her life forever.
So the Oregon Youth Authority has a major role that it plays in this whole sex offender youth registry. What does its response look like to that?
They're involved in the treatment program. They have clients, their offenders write clarification letters. Their treatment program actually is in does cognitive retraining so that the offender can change the way they think about things, anger management, impulse control. They even do a lot of sex education for the youthful offenders. I would like to say that the Oregon Youth Authority has the best treatment program for juvenile sex offenders of any state in the country. So one of the interesting things about Oregon is not only do we do youthful sex offenders remain on the registry for life unless they can prove to a judge that they have been rehabilitated and are not a danger anymore, but Oregon has the largest number of people on the sex registry of any state in the union on a per capita basis. And it's not just a slight amount more. Oregon has a significantly higher per capita rate. And frankly, I don't think it's because Oregonians are any worse than anyone else. I think it's because once on the registry, at least for juveniles, you're on for life.
So do you have a percentage for us? What percent of Oregonians are sex offenders?
The sex offender registry in Oregon, there are 19,000 people on it right now. 18,000 of those are men. And I've heard estimates that there are about 1,700,000 men over the age of 12 in Oregon. And when you do the math, it comes out to 1 out of every 100 men over the age of 12 are on the Oregon Sex Offender Registry. So probably somebody you know.
So do you have a message for our audience right now, Vicki?
I have several messages. One is, I think parents need to talk to their kids. because especially the age of 13 is the average age of our client at the clients at the time of the offense, and it also happens to be the national average of the age of youthful sex offenders. So talk to your kids and let them know that it can have lifelong consequences. And I think that's even more important as they get older. If you have a son or a daughter who's 18 and they're dating someone who's younger, have that talk, because if somebody gets mad at them, there could be lifelong consequences for a sexual relationship when one person is 18 and one is younger. I guess another message would be to talk to your legislators, because if you really believe that there's value in the sex offender registry, let's get it down to a size where it has some chance to actually make a difference. And there are easy ways. If a juvenile sex offender has not reoffended for some period of time, then it seems to me they deserve a fresh start. But we need to get that message to our legislators. And then I think the last one is just keeping an open mind. When you hear that someone is on the sex offender registry, don't assume that it's a sexual predator. It may be someone who, as a child, did something pretty stupid.
Okay, Vicki, thank you very much once again for coming here and sitting for the interview tonight. Again, we've been talking with Vicki Ballou, who is associated with the CLIF Project, Changing Lives Forever. It's a project of pro bono legal counsel for individuals who have been adjudicated as sex offenders and forced to register for the Adult Sex Offender Registry here in the Oregon area, and getting that registry requirement struck and off. I want to say thank you again for being here, Vicki. Do you have any last words for us?
Kids are different.
Are you a veteran with hearing loss? Saturday, June 29th, Hearing Loss Solutions for Veterans will take place from 8:45 to 5:30 at the Oregon Convention Center in Portland. It features